docket number 84800. And then, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes?
Perfect.
Okay. You can start whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Justices.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Roger Croteau. I'm here for the respondents in the instant appeal. We're here on a matter where I think is of grave importance, candidly. It's whether or not NRS 86 is going to protect a single purpose entity under the provisions of an LLC and having a single member operate and own that LLC, and whether or not we can set aside the protections offered under NRS 86 with minimal issues. And I mean minimal issues in the sense of alter ego. The ultimate law that was enacted in 2019 is NRS 86376, particularly subsection 2. It says a person acts as an alter ego of a limited liability company only if the limited liability company is influenced and governed by the person. Well, in all SPEs, right, single purpose entities for the most part, even if it's not just single purpose entities, but for the most part, many LLCs are used as entities that are formed for the protections. They're managed by the member or the owner. Our statute allows for both of that. So you almost get beyond the fact that, yes, the owner has an inseparable interest as the owner of the asset, but the entity was selected. And in our particular case, the entity is in good standing. The corporate formalities were adhered to. There was no commingling of funds in evidence. Testimony was that it filed independent taxes. There's testimony that it only received revenue in its name. In other words, it received revenue as International Property Holdings. It was not diverted to the name of the manager. The manager had a code to the property. And in furtherance of his business, he needed to verify the property was in good condition. The owner retained Quality Homes to do the leasing on the property, collect the fees, take a fee for that service. Quality Homes testified that they provided those funds to International Property Holdings, the entity. The purposes of the business enterprise was to make income. All of these things are set forth. And you know, the only case that's really, I guess, gives us good direction is Lorenz v. Belito. And in Lorenz v. Belito, though not dealing with NRS 86, it was dealing with the corporate statute that's identical. And in that particular provision, it said, here are the things you need to think about. And the final number three was, facts must be such that adherence to the fiction of separate entity would, under the circumstances, sanction a fraud or promote injustice. The problem we have is, what does promote injustice mean? I mean, that's really kind of where we're at. It's an ambiguous term. We identify fraud pretty simply, right? We made a misrepresentation, you relied upon it, and somehow you've defrauded me and I've suffered damages. Well, I don't know, promoting injustice is I guess, an innocuous term in some sense. You have to define it. In this particular case, as I grew up in the law and been trained, in the Lorenz court, it says, things that we need to look at, commingling of funds, undercapitalization, unauthorized diversion of funds, failure to observe corporate formalities. None of that occurred here at all. There is zero evidence of any of that.
Counsel, so, can I just ask you a couple quick questions about procedure? The record, unfortunately, was a little messy in terms of what happened. And so I'm just trying to get so alter ego was not pled as a cause of action, correct?
Correct.
Mr. Ean was let out at some point.
Correct.
And then he was brought back in.
Correct.
And how was he brought back in?
Just as an additional party. To be clear, there was a complaint filed on 4/27/17 that had Mr. N.A. in. But these were all of the aspects of the complaint were negligent based. There was absolutely no pleadings of alter ego of any kind. And obviously, I have objections with NRCP 15A argument to try and amend the pleadings after the trial's over.
It would actually be NRCP 15B, correct? Because
well,
that would happen after.
But right. They raised 15A in the motion. But I just, I think the objection is, A, it's dilatory, it's ambush, it's a lot of different things.
But when Mr. N.A. was brought back in, there was still no allegations of alter ego. I believe the
That's
allegation
correct.
Was that he was a co-owner of the
That's
property,
correct.
Correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and then... at the time of trial, I believe, to the best of my ability to decipher the record, Mr. N.A. testified, then he was brought back onto the stand to testify for a second time, and I believe his testimony really focused around the issue of alter ego, did it not?
It did, and that's because we got into an argument off record, if you will, where the court was trying to enter...
jury instructions.
Jury, thank you.
11A and 11B.
That I objected, patently objected to. Pursuant to NRS 86376.
To clarify something that Justice Lee was referring to, there wasn't any discovery sought on the idea of alter ego or any of the things that you've talked about, commingling of funds, corporate formalities, any of that. Because
None.
He was just in on negligence.
None.
Okay.
That is
and
correct.
When the judge starts talking about jury instructions that weigh in on the issue of alter ego theory, you all then decided to put your client back on the stand to address it?
To be more accurate, I objected to it on many grounds on the basis that, you know, all the things we just talked about, right? Ambush, all that sort of thing. And then NRS 86376 in subsection 3 says, the question of whether a person acts as an alter ego of a limited liability company must be determined by the court as a matter of law.
Right.
So it's not a question for the jury. That was the other side of the argument. And then that's when she had requested additional testimony, which we provided.
Okay. But you were the one that, or your side was the one that made the motion to have the court make that preliminary determination.
I made the motion, right?
Okay.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And again, the reasoning is, it wasn't based on the law. It wasn't properly before the jury, and I'll be candid with you. I thought based on the paucity of the evidence that there was hopefully it was going to be favorable.
And then just one other question. There's some evidence in the record that the subject property itself was ultimately transferred to a creditor. Was that done before the trial, during the trial, before the complaint was filed? Do you know?
Of course I do. Let's be more precise. If I may, just give me 2 seconds.
Sure.
The International Property Holdings was formed in April 6th of 2007. The property was transferred into that entity in July 8th of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
There were issues with Mr. N.A.'s business issues. And as a result of that, a deed was provided to the Popescus. But that was done on 7/20/16. At which point my client hadn't even been served of this complaint and had no knowledge of it. And then the complaint was originally filed on 4/27/17. So, and going through that litany, right? So you got 4/27/17, the complaint. On 10/21/19, you had an amended complaint. On 2/7/20, you had a second amended complaint where Mr. N.A. was out. Then you had 12/31/21, where a third amended complaint where he was brought back in. But the allegations have changed. And then we were set for trial in April. So, I mean, we had from the time he came in to the time we had trial, it was roughly 6 months. And there had been no discovery on it. No discovery was conducted on it. And again, you know, the argument of I should have anticipated and done some motion in limine practice, they didn't even allow motions in limine practice on this case because we had a discussion with the judge and the judge wasn't at the... I guess the judge wasn't hearing me because basically, based on the administrative orders, we've added to the five-year rule.
Mm-hmm.
But the judge did not recognize that and forced it to go on the five-year plan. So it was on an accelerated schedule, and that created some difficulties. But I would have never raised it as a motion in limine if it's not raised in the pleadings anyway. I mean, I'm not going to go out and find theories to go defend against in motion limine practice, certainly if it's not raised in the complaint. So, I mean, again, you know, I think there's two things. A, there's that issue. The second issue is, what is manifest injustice? I mean, I think that's an ultimate problem. I mean, you know, as a practitioner who does this all the time, I mean, we put things in, I call them SPEs, the banks require them. If the bank's lending on a property. They require the borrower to guarantee at a minimum. I mean, if it's not in their name, they require a guarantee. They require an SPE because a single purpose entity, that way it limits liability on their lending. This is done all the time. And it can be done in an LLC. It can be done in a corporation. It just depends. But the issue is, what is enough to create an alter ego problem here? The evidence in this case is this. He had a gate code. A, he needed it as manager. He had a special gate code. Why? Because they changed the gate code every time they rented it, right? So the person would have a gate code. They'd be able to get in, use the property, leave, change the gate code. My client had a consistent one, if you will, as did Quality Homes, had a consistent one because they were renting the property. Thank you. They were renting the property. So that's not evidence. The biggest thing that they have evidence on is that he used, when the property wasn't being used, a minimal time over an 8 or 9 or 10 year period for a few hours at a time where he'd have a birthday party at the property or something of that nature. That's it. Never slept at the property, never used it as a residence. His 85-year-old father used less than 1% of the square footage of the property that didn't offend anybody or any income generation for a little vegetable garden in the corner in the back of the property on 2.5 acre parcel, used 500 square feet.
Were there chickens on the property?
Yeah, some chickens.
Okay.
And I didn't delve into whether or not the eggs went to the unit as part of the iteration, but I didn't. And you know, the argument is that he didn't pay himself for the use of the property when he did the birthday parties. I submit to you, if you own a restaurant and you eat at the restaurant, you invite your family at the restaurant, you don't charge your family. Have you now created an alter ego problem? There has to be some reasonableness to this. And there has to be some guidance. I asked the judge directly, and it's quoted in here. I said to the judge, I said, could you please tell me what the basis is, for the injustice inquiry? And she basically tells me that, no, I've already gone through it. I said, please tell me what you define as manifest injustice. I mean, I don't see it personally. That's why I'm here. And she said, we've talked about it millions of times. So we're just moving forward. Okay. And so what ends up happening, I'm not here debating whether my client's responsible for 10% of the bill. I think that the jury ruled. They found him 10% responsible. We're fine with that. The issue is whether or not he's joint and severally responsible for International Holdings on a personal basis. And that's really the ultimate issue. So, I think that unless you have any questions, I'd like to save this 2.5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
We'll add a minute on to each of your topics on our questioning.
Thank you, Ron.
Mr. Fung?
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is John Funk, and I represent the respondent, Laura Graham, in this action, where we are asking this court to affirm the district court's findings as a matter of law that a manager of an LLC can be found personally liable under alter ego for the injuries that respondents sustained on a negligently maintained raised water valve cover.
But counsel, why wasn't this alter ego claim brought up before trial?
Well, part of it is the allegations of the negligence claim that they weren't maintaining it. And I think that we initially had the deposition testimony of Video Any, where he was testifying, placing all the entire blame over on the Quality Homes and Mr. Clipper. So it was based upon his representations at 30B6 deposition that we let him out. And ironically, during that same time period, Mr. Couteau had inadvertently answered for Quality Homes. So we had a little bit of confusion that was going on there. It wasn't until we took the deposition of Richard Clipper that we learned that everything that Ovidiu Eni had said was not correct. It was in dispute.
Why at that point when you brought him back in, didn't you allege an alter ego?
Well, it wasn't until I think we got into trial where the evidence really began to play out, where it was the inconsistencies that began to develop, where we felt at that time that it was appropriate, even though we moved under the wrong statute, we should have done under NRCP 12B to move to amend the complaint to bring in the alter ego statute. Yeah. But the argument is
15B?
Pardon?
Did you say 12B?
I think I said 15B.
It should be 15B. I thought you said
12B. I did. I should have said 15B. I apologize.
Okay.
But that's where we believe that it's harmless, though, because both any as well as the LLC were named parties through the entire litigation.
But was there any discovery done specifically on alter ego? That's my concern, counsel, because when you raise an issue for the first time at trial and it hasn't been explored in discovery because the defendant has no notice that you are suing him for that specific theory. The theory is that he was a part owner of the property, which is markedly different than an alter ego theory. So was there any discovery done to find out whether or not the company was undercapitalized, whether there was any commingling of the funds, if corporate formalities were followed? Was any of that undertaken by either side during discovery?
The problem is that the only documents that we ever received from the appellants in this case was one single document, which was the insurance that was from Allstate. That was the only document that they ever produced. That was the one that alerted us to let us know that the property was in Annie's name, that the insurance was also in Annie's name individually, which also prompted one of the jurors to even ask the question, inquiring, why, if there's so many entities, is the insurance in your name and not in the LLC? So we believe that there is no ambush or surprise here, because the allegations that we've been seeking throughout the discovery through the deposition testimony all supported that we were arguing that they were one and the same from the very beginning.
What is the causal connection, Ben? Let's say that everything you say is true. The property was in his name. The insurance was in his name. And I would proffer that's not entirely unusual when you have rental property. But let's say that all of those things are true. There has to be some kind of causal connection between those facts and the injury that was sustained or the harm that befell your client. And I'm failing to see that bridge. So maybe you can, and I don't think the judge below articulated it very well. I agree that with your counsel over here that it just wasn't articulated by the court very well.
And that's why I think that we were criticized for the use of the totality of the circumstances, but I think that that was the way that the judge kind of approached it and analyzed the issue, particularly when looking at the three prongs mm-hmm. that you have to meet. In looking at that third prong, the court specifically was commenting about the first two prongs, which there was no, like, he talks about the corporate formalities, but there were no corporate formalities. The reality is, as the court pointed out, when this property wasn't being rented, it was for personal use, and that personal use was not resulting in compensation to the corporation, which it can be inferred that the same thing is when he's utilizing the property for the birthdays, that he's still going to have to, somebody's got to clean it up. And that doesn't take into consideration, well, what about Richard Clipper? He's going to be stuck footing that bill. So there is the harm. There is the justification that I think that the court looked at was his not use of the property, but we would submit abuse of the property. As counsel has tried to downgrade it, there was an entire chicken coop on this property with a dozen
but
chickens.
But that chicken coop didn't cause your client's injury, counsel. So that's what I'm trying. It almost appears as if you're taking the first two prongs and collapsing them into the third prong. You have to also show a manifest injustice. So I could understand if you came here and said, well, he was transferring all of the assets out of this company for his own personal use, thereby rendering the company insolvent, and now my client doesn't have a source to collect from. But that's not what you're saying. That's not what the court said. So I'm just trying to figure out, you have to tie in the alter ego analysis with the prejudice or the harm. And I'm still not understanding how having a chicken coop or a little garden or the gate code or the insurance had anything to do with your client's injury or her ability to collect for that matter, because it's just not in the record.
Well, but it's his ownership and control of it mm-hmm. where he has, it's the, I would say it's the combination of those three where the lack of injustice and the manifest injustice is the fact that as the court, as you'd pointed out, Justice Lee, and in the questions, was when was that property transferred? is we raised the issue and we brought up the fact that he had a felony conviction for mortgage fraud to lay the foundation and the basis to try to establish the fraud that was necessary, which the court didn't necessarily go into and address in detail. But the argument was that he was utilizing, engaging, and making use of this property in a way that was outside of its intended use, which is to generate income where he wasn't compensating. But the simple fact is that the harm is that he allowed and let this property lapse and fall into bankruptcy, where he lost the asset to where there is basically no recovery for the 50% against the LLC, because it was literally only formed for the express purpose of being able to rent the property in question. So
doesn't it seem like all of these things that we're talking about here would have been appropriate for discovery and then a more proper presentation at trial? Not a on the fly at trial, say, now I want to add alter ego theory, and we're kind of on the fly trying to address some of these things. And it just seems like the court, I don't disagree with the court making, and Mr. Courteau making a motion to rule as a matter of law, that issue is a matter of law. But it feels like not really trying the issue, but being forced to address the issue in the middle of trial. Where it would have been a lot cleaner. And I get it. The judge kind of told you guys, hey, you got to go to trial, 5-year rule. I'm sorry. So you don't get to do pretrial motions in limine and kind of address a lot of things. But it just seems pretty messy.
Yeah, no, there were some issues with how it got to trial. But at the same time, there was a history that we got to trial where there should have been that discovery on those issues. We had completed our discovery by taking Ennie's deposition, where we knew what he was going to say at trial. And then we also took Clippers. So it was our position, though, that there was sufficient evidence that the use was sufficient enough to amount to abuse, to where we're asking that the court does uphold the district court's decision here in finding the alter ego.
But I mean, I understand what you're saying here today in court. Okay, go ahead. Yes, please.
I'm just struggling to find what evidence was presented. And again, the corporate cloak is not lightly thrown aside. We've said that for a very good reason. A lot of things that we've talked about about the first two factors, alter ego, you know, that's pretty common. That's a really common thing. We've said that before as well. But what was presented that shows that there was commingling of funds, undercapitalization, unauthorized diversion of funds? I mean, when you're piercing a corporate veil, that's a big deal. Yeah. And what even came out during trial that would support piercing this corporate veil?
Well, as we had said, I think the court pointed out in the Loomis case, where the essence of the alter ego doctrine is to do justice whenever it appears that protections provided by the corporate form are being abused.
And again, I'm stuck there. Where was the abuse here?
The abuse is just his treatment of the property as his own personal property. It's the fact that he's claiming that it's only supposed to be for income purposes, yet you've got a garden that has to be tended to, you've got chickens that still need to be fed, and I keep going back to these, but those all show that commingling that we discussed, that shows that there is no division of the interest, that it's all one entity and one person and one being. When he's not renting it, he's utilizing it where he's not compensating.
Doesn't that seem kind of petty in the whole scope of, you know, the sanctity of that entity and piercing that corporate veil?
Well, the issue is the harm that occurred from the, you know, the respondent with her address here, where I think that the evidence was sufficient to show that corporate structure was just, it was a facade. All right.
You still have 4 minutes and 56 minutes. Right.
Any other questions?
We give you the little bell and let you know.
Okay.
We just let you know.
Five minutes. Yeah. Right. All right.
And so, counsel, a lot of the things that you're saying here today, I think that would have maybe strengthened your arguments during trial. But unfortunately, I don't see those things in the record. So if you're saying that he failed to maintain the property because he was treating it as his own, and that's why the sprinkler head was sticking up above ground, and that's why your client was injured, at least we kind of get closer to the causal connection, the nexus that is necessary and mandated to pierce the corporate veil, because I agree with my colleague that it is very difficult to pierce the corporate veil, and I'm struggling to understand how any of those things, even if we assume they're all true, caused your client injury.
Well, but it's the fact that we're alleging it was the failure to do those things in his capacity as that manager or the owner of the property.
Well, then he's protected by the corporate veil, right?
Well, that's what he's attempting to argue here with his going out to the property and attempting to inspect it, which those we submitted did not occur, which is what the trier of fact, I think, also found. But
okay. All right. Well, I appreciate the spirit of debate. Right. I understand. Thank you so much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. A couple things in comment to counsel. First off, the property was in great condition, just so we're on the same page. I mean, it was renting for approximately $1,500 a day, at the time. The property was very, very well maintained. The difficulty was in the grass, there was a junction box for the water system, the irrigation system. And I guess it eroded a little bit over time, and it created a little bit of a lip. There's testimony that if it's in a walkway, it needs to be flush. The argument was, in the dirt, it still needs to be flush. Again, that was the basis of the claim. And it's not as if we're talking about a property that's poorly maintained or not done correctly. He did his job as the manager of that LLC. He hired an independent contractor who booked the listings, did everything they're supposed to do. He didn't collect the rent. They did. They took their 15%. They paid him net 85%. He paid all the bills. He did so on an ongoing basis. He was not undercapitalized. The property was worth a significant amount of money, substantially less than the debt at the point that was due. So there is no evidence. It's not a positive evidence. There's no evidence of the things that I understand to mean all piercing the corporate veil.
Could you address the bankruptcy issue?
Sure.
I was a little unclear about that.
I can, Your Honor. It's rather complicated, but if I may. I was involved in that too. So what ended up happening is Mr. N.A. had multiple business properties over, a series of deals. And one of the deals with the Propescu's in a prior time had gone somewhat sideways. And as additional security for them, he pledged the equity in the Oquendo property, completely unrelated to this. Mm-hmm. And as things go, we were in a bad time when all that was being done, economically, and it took a bad turn, and they executed on their deed. So, I mean, that's all it is. Again, there was zero even notice of this to my client, the injury. He had not even heard of it until the lawsuit came in, and the transfer occurred before that. There was absolutely no basis. And as far as counsel saying, well, we gave them everything they asked for. Okay, they asked one of the discovery questions to tell us what the insurance on the property is. We gave it to them. We didn't object. We answered everything. There was no discovery disputes whatsoever. There was no motions to compel. There was no discovery we didn't respond to. This was a really straightforward slip and fall case. That was it.
Is there anything in the record that indicates the insurance was insufficient or unavailable
to
satisfy this claim?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't believe so. I objected to the insurance coming in generally because of difficulties with that presenting to a jury, if you will. I objected to that. It came in over to that objection on the basis of showing ownership. There is zero dispute from a legal perspective. International Property Holdings owned this property in its own name. Mr. N.A. had no personal ownership in it whatsoever after 7-8 of 08. He operated this business for 7 years prior to this injury without mishap. Operated it after the injury without mishap. As far as I know, it's the only action that's ever been brought at any point in time that the property was used as a rental property. It's been the only allegation. And again,
can I just ask one clarifying question? The relief that you're seeking from us today, you said you don't take umbrage with the 10% that was assigned to Mr. Ney. So what is it that you're taking issue with? You said the joint.
I would like the alter ego portion of the case dismissed, and therefore the joint and several liability would go away against my client being responsible for International Property Holdings 50% of the judgment. Okay. And as the court's aware, I'm sure, Ms. Graham was responsible for 40%. She was walking backwards when she hit the... so, I mean, that's the nature of it. And again, I think the court has clear understanding of our position, but there is nothing in the record, and Your Honors have obviously keyed in on that. There's nothing in the record that would warrant piercing the corporate veil. If we create case law that allows piercing of the corporate veil on this scintilla of evidence that had nothing to do with the operation or income of the property, that didn't interfere with it. My client didn't use the property if it was being rented. And even his use was maybe once a year we'd have a birthday party. Literally, we're talking like this is so de minimis that we would eviscerate any single person, single person entity or from the fear of being caught up in something else. And does it change if I add two people? I don't know. If someone still does something wrong, does it change? I mean, it's a slippery slope. And I think it needs to be held to a higher standard. This should be the rarity, not the solution.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you both for the briefing, for the arguments today. I appreciate it very much. The matter will stand submitted, and we will be in recess until further call of the court. Thank you.